Graham Allen Reel 7.
I wasn't in Kampong Makassar for more than, I think, 6 months, and I was moved back to the camp in Jakarta, and then, oh, I'm sorry, I'm using the word Jakarta, I should have said Batavia. So far we've been down in Batavia, and it wasn't until after Kampong Makassar that we were moved up to central Java, to Jakarta, which had been a very pleasant camp in the early days, but when we got there, it was nothing like that. And the food was very bad, and we weren't in the original camp anyway. We were moved into a place which was just Attap huts, and infested with bed bugs. From there, things got gradually worse until, towards the end of the war, we were moved to a boys' reformatory, which had been built for about 600 boys and was now accommodating something like 1,500, 2,000 officers. It was surrounded with high walls, and the accommodation inside was terrible, with three layers of bunks in each room, each large hall, three layers of bunks, and so you had about 18 inches per man. The sanitation was terrible, and in fact, I think the Japanese would have been only too happy if there had been a serious epidemic and wiped most of us out. It's the only place where I've seen people queuing up to go to the loo day and night. And in fact, if you wanted to go to the loo, the best time was about 2 in the morning when the rush hour was eased a bit. Now, we still had the radio, and information gradually trickled through as before. And the senior officers in charge of us were very, very worried about what would happen when the war came to an end. And we're now talking of sort of early 1945. And, of course, again, they were very careful about what they told everybody. But we realized that there was going to be, there was likely to be a bust-up, and we would probably be mown down. This was reinforced when we were all told to get outside, and we had to dig some large trenches, which we were told were for air raid precautions, but it seemed to most of us that it was more likely to be for our own graves. And so the senior officers devised a plan for trying to for resisting should the Japanese decide to exterminate us, and to cause enough delay to allow two or three or parties or groups to get out of the camp and escape into the bush, and rely upon their being able to persuade the Indonesians that their future lay did not lie with the Japanese but with the Allies. I knew very little about this, but I can tell you about what happened when the war did end. Well, we knew from that we were told that there had been that the atom bombs had been dropped. That we did know
through the radio,
and so we were told great confidence. Don't talk about it to each other, but that's what's happened. And of course, we didn't know really what the atom bomb was or could do. We were then told that the Japs had surrendered, but not a sign came from the locals. Now we know that there were local generals, Japanese generals, were in two minds as to whether to fight on till the end or to obey the order from the Japanese government to pack it in. And in fact, I think it needed the Japanese crown, one of the Japanese crown princes, to be flown down to the East Indies by the Americans to persuade the local generals that they had to admit defeat. Anyway, as far as we were concerned, we knew that the war was over, and we knew that the Japanese made no sign at all. So it was all a very fraught time. You had to be careful not to put your nose out of, get out of step, you know, you had to be careful to be sure that they couldn't find any fault with what was going on in the camp. Until about 2 weeks after the war was, as I say, over, our senior officer was summoned to the Japanese and was told, and these are the words I remember, he was told by the Japanese that the war is now over and we are now honourable friends. So this was a bit of a facer, as you can imagine.
You've got to know how to react.
Well, the first thing was that as the honourable friends had all their guns and the power and they were there and we were still under their thumb, the obviously the thing was to keep a po' face and say nothing much and say, yes, sir. Good. Well, our senior officer immediately made three demands. One was, the first one, quite rightly, was we want a public radio system. Two, we want more food, and three, we want to get out of there and get down to back to Batavia. The radio was provided, and the radio was provided, and this provided me with, well, with all of us, with the most, excuse me, with the most emotional moment. I thought it was set up. In an open space in this prison, and near the entrance, and it was a loudspeaker on some supports, putting it about 8 feet high in the air, and then we all gathered in front of it, and it was tuned in to receive the Radio Southeast Asia from SEAC, and the first we heard was Lily Bolero. I can't remember that, can't hear that tune these days without thinking of that moment. You know, it almost brings tears to the eyes. It really was such a moment. And then you heard the news, you see, what was actually happening. And of course, from then it was, you know, the whole situation, of course, changed. Our morale was way up, and we were moved out of the camp. More food was provided, but really, the food was.
What was the attitude of the Japanese?
Oh, the Japanese attitude was nauseating. I mean, all the time when we were prisoners, every Allied prisoner, no matter what his rank, had to salute a Japanese soldier, no matter how low his rank. So, and if you didn't salute him, you were beaten up. Well, as soon as all this was announced, that we were honourable friends, Japanese officers were saluting us, Japanese soldiers were saluting us, and you had to salute them back, you see, out of politeness, you know. Altogether, I mean, they had been told that the war was over, we're honourable friends, you will now salute them, and so the Japanese did exactly as they were told. But I had the inescapable impression that if the Japanese had been told, and you will shoot the bloody lot, they would have shot us, you know, without any compunction, and they didn't see anything illogical in behaving in that way. They were just doing exactly as they were told, which, you know, they were brainwashed, of course, into it, you see, so you can't really blame them. But it was really, you might say, a bizarre situation that they were treating you. Yeah. I don't know if we've got time. When we got back to Batavia, there was, into the same camp, of course it was almost, you might say, a camp flowing with milk and honey. And some working parties were allowed out to go to help in the women's camps to do some heavy work. Though I thought myself that seemed to be rather pointless, because the women in the women's camp had done all the heavy work for 3 years, and I didn't see why they needed any help then. But obviously a lot of Dutchmen had their wives there and wanted to go and see them, you see. So some working parties went out. A lot of the men, a lot of hot-headed chaps wanted to get out on the town, and they had to be strongly discouraged because the Indonesians had started their nationalist movement, and they were not going to let the Dutch back in charge. And so you were well advised to, you know, keep inside the camp. Just to go back a little bit, I should say that the circumstances of the release of the news of the end of the war, which came in this Boyce Reformatory to us, is described by Lawrence van der Post in one of his books, which, to my mind, has no resemblance to reality whatever.
Was he there?
Oh, he was there, yes, he was there. According to him, he did it all. He was the one who negotiated with the Japanese and et cetera, et cetera. But don't believe
what
he did. Not that I saw at all.
What sort of a chap was he in those days?
Oh, affable. Always gave the impression that he was... he was able to convey this impression that he was terribly well-informed. The man behind the scenes. He was the one who was really pulling the strings, you see. But he never became the senior officer, although he was, so to speak, he called himself a lieutenant colonel, which we now know was completely a fabrication. He was never the senior officer who had to go and confront the Japanese and complain or something and get beaten up for his trouble, as they did. He was always sort of in the background, you see, and... I say his story of being released is rubbish. In fact, he used it. The whole impression I got of him was that if he did talk to junior officers in general about matters, political or anything, it was always kind of, I know all sorts of things that I'm afraid I are too confidential to tell you chaps, you see. And we always thought he was a bit of a line spinner at the time. He made a very good career out of it, but his book is Tailspinner? There's a very good book. Storyteller.
Uh-huh.
Storyteller by Martin Woollacott, is it? Who is, which debunks him very well. And, right, so back to the end of the war. So there we were, back down in Batavia with land flowing with milk and honey. Some working parties went out. I was put in charge. They wanted somebody to look after the kitchen. Now, the looking after the kitchen was, of course, would have been a plum job, you might say, previously. But it wasn't much sort of then because everybody had plenty to eat. All right. I should go back about a year to about sometime in 1944 when I was in Java before we got to this reformatory camp, and drafts were being prepared to go north to work, of course, on the Siam Railway. And these were viewed with, we weren't sure of course where one was going to, but really it was a case of the devil you knew, and people were not very keen to go on these. Anyway, it was inevitable, and the Japanese would require, say, 200 or 300 men, so many officers of the rank of about captain, so many of lieutenant or sub-lieutenant, and these all had to be, names had to be handed in and approved, and then the draft would be prepared and off they go. Well, when I was in one of these camps, my name was put down on to go on a draft, and one was sort of, I suppose, fatalistic about it. You knew that it was inevitable, and one just hoped for the best. However, about a day before we were due to go, or 2 days before, I went down with a bout of malaria, which was recurrent. And I was lying on my bunk, you know, shivering and heavy sweat. And so my name was taken off the list, and another sub-lieutenant from HMS Encounter, a friend of Sam Falls, called Hank Hazelton, a Canadian, very soft-spoken, gentle, big lad, pleasant lad, Hank. And he was put on instead, and he came to see me, and I said, I'm sorry, Hank, you know, to let you in for this. And he said, oh, that's okay, you know, don't you worry, it's all right, I'll be okay. So off he went on this draft, and the whole ship was sunk, every man was lost. And he and the other person who was a doctor was lost on that. And I've always thought, you know, that was a remarkable bit of fortune, good fortune, ill fortune, which makes one feel uneasy, really. You know, and I can't look back on it now without feelings of regret and relief and knowing that, you know, one had a very narrow brush with death and that. But I always remember Hank, he was such a nice chap.
Mm. I mean, you had several nationalities. I mean, who did the Brits tend to get on best with in the camp?
Oh, I think by the time we had been together for some time, the Brits and the Australians and were all, and the New Zealanders, we were all very much together. The Japanese lumped us together, really, and together with the Americans. For some occasions, they seemed to separate them, but they usually kept the Dutch separate, fairly separate accommodations. So one didn't mingle with the Dutch unless you really sought to do so, but they were from very nice Dutch chaps who one spoke to quite a bit, but on the whole, one, all the, you might say, the Anglophone people tended to lump together. When I say they were all lumped together, there were occasions when the Japanese thought it right not to do so, and that was the two occasions I recall were occasions when we had a Red Cross parcel. Now the first time that happened, there weren't enough Red Cross parcels to go around, as one could imagine, because the Japanese army obviously used them up themselves, and they didn't have any shipping to send them down from Tokyo to the Far East. And so on the first occasion, we had one Red Cross parcel between two, so we had half each. On the next occasion, the Japanese wanted to give every American in the camp a Red Cross parcel and split the rest amongst everybody else pro rata, which meant that the Americans got one each or more, I think, and the rest were going to get about a 50th. And the American officers would have none of that. And so they were all split up, and we got one between 16. So that was what the Japanese logic was, goodness knows, but I digress.
Were they trying to sort of chummy up with the Americans?
I possibly were, yeah. I think possibly they were. Probably they saw that this some order had come down that, you know, the Americans had better be treated a bit more gently.
Yeah. Did you chat to Americans very much?
Oh, yes, quite a bit. Yes, indeed, there were some great characters amongst them. They really were, and they, breath of fresh air, you know, different outlook on life altogether, you see. There were some very, very nice blokes. And
there wasn't any post or anything, was there? Or mail or?
No mail came in. We were able to send messages once or twice, I think. And I think, yes, these messages did get home very slowly. And, of course, in my particular case, they reached my uncle in London, whose surname was Allen, and who I had given as my next of kin. And then he had to then try to get that same information across to my parents, who were in Jersey under German occupation. So it was another several months before they got any news that I was still alive. But that was, by the way.
Did you think about home a lot, or were you so involved?
Oh, yes. Oh, no. One had plenty of time to think about home, you know, and didn't do it to brood about it. Yes, one didn't. One knew that they were under German occupation, but of course one had no idea whether it was benign or or what it was like. You see, as it happens, we know it wasn't, in some respects, wasn't too onerous in Jersey, but of course it's left its scars to this day.
What did you worry about in the camps?
Well, I suppose really one worried basically about survival, and secondly about food. It really was, one was continually hungry, no doubt about that. And so that was really the major problem, survival. How on earth are we going to get out of here? And the Japs showed no sign of any sort of, you might say, reasonable approach to these problems. It was, you knew that they were absolutely brainwashed into complete and utter obedience.
There's never any thought of escape or...
Oh, no fear. Well, after the first few weeks of captivity, this was in Makassar, all of that was realized. We realized it was completely out of question because my friend Sam Fall and two other officers, decided they would escape. But fortunately for them, three Dutch officers had already decided, and these were Dutch officers who had lived in the West, in the East Indies. They knew the language, they knew a lot of the natives, they thought they were, they thought they could persuade somebody to sell them a boat and they would get away. So they escaped, but they completely misjudged the feeling of the Indonesians at the time, who of course disliked the Dutch intensely, who had been dominating and unpleasant colonial masters. And when the Japanese arrived, the Indonesians were only too glad to see the back of the Dutch. Whether they believed the Japanese promises of freedom and independence is another matter, but when these three Dutchmen escaped, they were turned in the next day. Well, they were severely beaten, and after several days of that sort of thing, they were beheaded. And everybody in the camp who had been in the same hut as they were in were also beaten and had no food for days. The message was very clear, and I remember our senior officers saying to Sam and his friends, on no account you to try to escape, because you just bring... You haven't got a hope, and B, you're only going to bring disaster on the rest of the camp, you see, and all to no avail. And so Sam, I know, was very keen to escape, but he realized, he had to obey orders, and he knew it was quite impossible. So after that, there was never any question of trying to escape. It was, too many thousands of miles of sea between you and anywhere, and no because in Indonesia, you would have stood out mile from amongst the general population.
Did you tend to have an idea of what the date was? And
oh, we knew what the dates were. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we knew what the dates were. That was all. We kept, we were aware of all that. No problem there. I say, and of course, we did our best, I say, to try to give, live as civilized as possible. And, of course, amongst the men, I know that there were one or two men who rather thought that, well, now we're prisoners, that King's regulations no longer apply and they don't have to say yes sir, no sir to the officers, etc. And one of our senior officers put them, naval officer, put them severely in their place and pointed out that they were still in the Navy. Their wives were still getting their allowances and their pay was still waiting for them when they got back. And... don't think for a minute that well, that all assumed, of course, that they were going to get out alive.
Yeah.
As most of them did think.
Were there any sort of cultural activities, or I put it that way?
Yes, at times. In the early days, great effort was made to just do some, have some entertainment. And there were concerts. But, and up in Bandung, a lot of Air Force people were incarcerated, in the early days, they had a great deal of freedom, and they had concert parties, etc. But the Japanese soon stopped that, and we weren't allowed any sort of sing-song at all. It was, whether they thought we'd all be singing Rule Britannia, I don't know. But obviously they didn't know, if somebody was telling a funny story, they didn't know whether it was a funny story per se, or whether it was a funny story against the Japanese, you see. And so the obvious answer was to ban the lot. And so you might say for the last 3 years, there was no entertainment or sing-song allowed at all.
How long were you in altogether?
About 3 years, 8 months.
Phenomenal length of time.
It did seem a long time, and if you told us that at the very beginning, I'm sure our morale would have collapsed. Yeah. But we all thought, you know, oh, it can't last another month or two, and we'll be, look at the Americans are invading the you know, these islands, and they're soon being, etc. But of course, we didn't know then that the Japanese had issued this order, well, towards the end of the war, you know, that as soon as the first Allied troops landed in Japan, or I think November the 1st, whichever was the sooner, all Allied prisoners would be shot. And that is, you know, that document is extant and is quite true.
How would you change, can you sum it up at all, from the day you arrived in a camp to the day you left the last camp?
Well, of course, when I went, as I only went in at the age of, 19, you see, when I went in. And, of course, I was 23 when I came out. So one had changed anyway in that sort of period, you know. I suppose, in a way, I hadn't changed as much as I might have done had I gone through the war and survived, you know, and had been involved in more action. In a way, I suppose that one was perhaps... hesitate to say suffering from arrested development, but in a way you were in a sort of a limbo, and there wasn't much chance of much development, because you couldn't, you just got older and perhaps and took on more responsibilities, but that was really about all, you see. And of course we did feel, other people who were in my position also had gone in at my age, we did feel, you know, that life was passing us by. And that there were other people getting promotion, and there we were, you know, just stuck and forgotten about, you see, which wasn't true, I suppose, but there we are.
Mm. Homosexuality is constantly talked about these days, but wasn't mentioned as much then. Was that...
Well, you know, I dare say it happened, but frankly, I honestly don't know anything about it. When we were... in the early days, in some camps, you had a lot of Dutch officers and Dutch conscripts of the later population, and there were some very pretty little boys, you know, you thought to yourself, well, I hope they're quite safe. I wonder, you know, but didn't attract us. These were Indonesian boys, but some of them looked very, you know, very jolly. But I say it didn't bother us. Now, in the camp itself, as far as the British, the naval and army personnel were concerned, I didn't see any sign of it at all. I mean, I had a good friend who I shared a mosquito net with him for years, about 2 years, because you know, a valuable thing, mosquito net. And we used to sleep side by side and compare boils and ulcers and things. You know, there was never any tendency like that. I mean, we all thought that our sexual powers were waning because the food was so bad. But we never had any... There was no homosexuality at all. But maybe it went on, but it certainly was so discreet and anyway, nobody suspected it. As you know, nowadays, I think a lot of it is just, idle speculation, really.
Mm. Yeah, right. Graham Allen, end of reel 7.